Hello, everyone. Welcome to the inaugural episode of Steel City Surgeons, a podcast focused on showcasing the culture of the Department of Surgery at the University of Pittsburgh. I am your host, Sidra Khan, a current general surgery resident at the University of Pittsburgh. Each episode, I'll have with me a few medical students who will have the opportunity to dig into the lives of a diverse group of accomplished surgeons. Today with me, I have two of our star medical students, Ashti Shah and Nandini Doshi.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having me today.
Great, thank you for coming. Both of them will have the opportunity to interview a remarkable surgeon, researcher, and leader in the field of endocrine surgery, Dr. Sally Carty. Dr. Carty, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a huge honor and delight to be here. Thank you so much.
You've had a phenomenal career and are truly a leader in the field of endocrine surgery and someone who has played a significant role in paving the path for many women surgeons as you trained in an era when there were few, if any, women in surgery. So we're super excited to have you to get this chance to get to know you better and learn from you. So Nandini and Ashti, I'm going to give the floor to you guys now.
Dr. Carty, so our first question for you is, in a time when not many women were physicians, what drove you to become a doctor in the first place and then a surgeon?
I was the eldest of a large family, and I grew up as a pseudo-parent for those children, and so I learned to help people and take care of people. And interestingly, a lot of physicians do have that role in their personal lives. So I knew I wanted to be a doctor, but I never thought I wanted to be a surgeon. I thought I wanted to be a psychiatrist or a pediatrician, which is the role that many women were pushed into.
When you decided to become a surgeon, did it take convincing yourself, your family, and peers that this is something that a woman can do?
Hugely. So I decided to become a surgeon out of the blue when I was standing at the scrub sink with a very accomplished, confident, ambidextrous, macho, but not as bad as everybody else, heart surgeon. And he said casually, "So, Carty, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Surgery, Dr. Hart." And I didn't know I was going to say that. And what was entrancing about surgery was basically everything. But I had to sell it to myself because I was training in a medical school where the medical students were treasured and treated well, but where the residents were horribly divisive about women trainees in anything, and where there were no women trainees in surgery. So I knew I was in for a hard row to hoe. My husband wasn't my husband then. We had been together like 3 years. And he's awesome, very funny, very smart, very insightful. And he had decided also to become a surgeon. And so this is in a time before the couples match that we had to figure out how to match together. We weren't yet married. Wow. And my lack of a ring was a problem at several schools. And I didn't want a ring. I was, you know, a hippie who was doing the best that she could to forge a new world. So it was very hard to believe that I wanted to be a surgeon and to teach the people around me to let me be a surgeon.
Do you remember what the reaction was like of that surgeon who you told
at
the
scrub tank? They all just laughed at me. During residency, my husband and I ended up in the same residency in order to stay together, and because there was no couples match. And I knew, as I said, I knew it was going to be really hard there, and it was. They did a lot of overtly misogynist, hostile, brutal things, not just the other residents, but the other attendings. And if you want to take 10 minutes and have me tell you some of them, I will. When you scrub with me in the OR, sometimes I'll blurt them out, because the OR is a very sharing experience. Did I blurt them out to you, Sidra?
A little bit.
Uh-huh. So, you know, I don't want to engender legal issues by mentioning anybody's names, mm-hmm. but one story I know I didn't tell you was that I was the first woman in surgery, the second woman ever there in the first in 10 years. And by the time I was a chief, there was one every year. And the intern, who later became a CT surgeon in Pittsburgh, was in the shower and in the call rooms. And everybody else, all the men, were sitting around in the call rooms shooting the breeze. And when I went out to answer a page or something, they pinned a note to her skirt that said, "Skirts, get out."
Wow.
And the residency director not a very effective leader, called a meeting and said, that's it, I've had enough, this is going to stop. And he didn't know all the things that had been happening to me because I was afraid to bring them up. And as he was saying this, with his cheeks flapping and his face red at the front of the room, one of the other chief residents sitting in the first row lifted his middle finger for the whole rest of the room to see at his back. And that was the response to this residency director's directive.
Wow.
So it was. That's just one of many examples of enabled, ensconced, encouraged, boys will be boys. It's okay to be mean to women, and it's okay to be mean to Cardi because she's the first of the women.
Wow, well, I feel like you have to be a very strong person and have an enormous amount of grit to be able to get through that kind of experience. But
do you think you are able to then, I guess, during, as an attending, yes, were you able to develop more courage to stand up to general gender discrimination? And how, yes, did you go about doing that?
So in college, I had been quite the feminist with many examples of overt, courageous action that I cannot speak about on the airwaves. but as then I had to go underground in residency. And then as an attending, it was better here. And I had the chance to breathe. And I also had the chance, I was the first woman in general surgery at Pitt, I had the chance to establish a culture. So I immediately started having twice a year teas for the women surgeons at my house. It was usually catered. You know, I grew the flowers. I made the scones with clotted cream, that whole bit. But it was a chance for everybody to get together outside of supervision and talk about what was on their mind. And it was very interesting to watch that over 30 years because at the beginning, people talked about men in their personal lives and men in their work lives. And then later, they began to talk about their careers and sometimes talk about their children or their lack of children or whether people with children were good or bad. But it became a more healthy discussion over time. That I did deliberately to set the tone. Another thing I did deliberately was around 1995, our first general surgery resident got pregnant and announced it to the faculty. And I knew that this was a moment for our faculty, all male except for me, I think. There might have been another woman by then, to do it right. And what did do it right mean? Well, the American Women Surgeons, the AWS, put out something called a pocket mentor. And what was the pocket mentor? It was a little tiny book. And why did they have to put it out? Because we didn't have any. Huh. We didn't have any mentors. We had this book, right? And the book said things like, don't have relationships with people at work, which may or may not have been appropriate. Who else am I going to be with? I'm at work 120 exactly, hours a week as a resident. Who else is there, right? But it also said things like, here's how pregnancy should be managed. And the chair at the time, Dick Simmons, was open to doing it right. And we followed it to the letter. Pregnancy is a medical condition like any other. You work full time until you're disabled by a medical condition. Then you get 6 weeks off, not 6 days.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. I had already had, I think I was having my second child when that happened. And with the first child, I had an emergency section at 38 weeks. And I went back to work 3.5 weeks later. And I was expected to make up call. But not fiscal productivity. And I didn't understand fiscal. There were no RVUs at that time, so gotcha. That was okay. With the second child, I had an emergency section at 42 weeks, 40 close. And I took the full 6 weeks because I was getting old. I was 38.
Good for you.
And with the third child I had when I was 42, so switching ahead into the future, that was 1998, I gave a paper at 2.5 weeks. In Florida, because it was a podium presentation, and I was honored to have received the chance. And she came with me and stayed upstairs in the room with my husband. So there was a lot of, even though we've set it up for the Department of Surgery that we were doing it right, it's very, what is the word, Sidra? It's very...
You're trying to say it's very hard to kind of convince yourself to follow...
Yeah, and it's very different from what we would call right today. It's all relative.
Right.
Yeah.
It is all very relative, definitely.
So there was a strange guy, a young guy, standing at the foot of the bed, staring at the patient's breasts, and who were exposed for prepping and draping. And I didn't know who he was, and I'm the captain of the ship. And so everybody else in the room was busy doing their work, the scrub nurse, the circulator, the resident. So I said, "And who are you?" And he said, "Well, who the hell are you?"
Oh, wow.
And the circulator, a man, said, "This is Dr. Carty. She's the surgeon. And who are you?" to this guy, who eventually led on that he was a trainee nurse who was there to observe. And the way he handled that further conversation made me just be done. And I said, "That's it. I don't know who you are. Get out of here. You're in the way, and you're being obstreperous. Get out." And he refused to leave. He just stood there. So what I would do today is a little different than what I did then, which is gather my wits and my self-control and my compassion for the patient and do her surgery. Okay? I kept myself together, even though I was tachycardic the whole time and furious. I did her surgery, and when I was done, I went out and found his boss, who was the head of nursing for the operating room, and said, "Here's what happened." And she said, "Well, it's not his fault. How was he to know you're not a normal surgeon?"
And that was counter to that would be, isn't it his fault to just be, I mean, respectful to any human being?
Oh, no. Well, see, that's a common tip-off, is I don't have to take that from you. Well, who do you take it from?
Yeah.
Right? That's a common statement to someone who's being derogated, who's being disrespected. I don't have to take that from you. Oh, really? Do you take it from men?
Right.
Okay. So that situation I wrote up as a morality anecdote for the Department of Surgery, and I said to the chairman at that time, we should discuss this at a surgery resident education conference, because there's a number of angles here. What about race? There was a medical student in the room. What if the medical student's race was the same or different from mine? What did they learn? The medical student happened to be a female. What did she learn watching this interchange? Which there was no recourse. I had to take it. Okay?
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Right. And so my suggestion, this is 13 years, 15 years ago, was discounted. But today, we have diversity M&M, which is a wonderful idea.
It really is. It's been so eye-opening.
What do you like about it?
I think for me it's eye-opening because these examples that we give are, you realize how common they are. Because, you know, you read an anecdote and you're like, yeah, that maybe happened to me once, but it probably is a once in a blue moon kind of thing. And then everyone else chimes in and be like, oh, yeah, that's happened. Oh, I've seen that. And it's just so eye-opening that, oh, my God, these things are still happening pretty frequently. I do think it's nice to hear that people are supportive, and you can, even the people who are quiet, you can tell that they are now realizing how common these situations are, and especially, you know, either if it's men or whoever the majority that we're talking about in their group is, I feel like they walk out of these M&Ms and with like a different mindset.
Yes. Even though they might not be listening with their full attention, or they might not be listening at all that day, there is culture change. And it's so great to talk about it with each other, because I've learned.
Right, exactly. And there's something different also about doing it so often by continuing to do this every single month,
and
right?
It's departmentally sponsored.
Exactly. It's departmentally sponsored. You do this every single month. I feel like people eventually start, even people who don't want to buy into topics or just don't think that, you know, like there's still issues with women in surgery, or there are issues in our department with race or gender. But eventually you hear this enough and people at some point start changing their mind. They're like, huh, maybe there is an issue and I'm just the one not seeing it.
Yes, maybe because it's almost all peer pressure, but not all peer pressure.
Right.
Right.
Sometimes you need that peer pressure.
Personally, I'm concerned about racism in the field. Can you expand a little more about your thoughts and your experiences, either observing racism within the department or within the field of general surgery?
Happy to, but let me preface it by saying that I'm an idiot about racism, and I'm still learning. I'm still learning how I commit bias and how we all commit bias every day. And what's really cool about not being squished like a bug as far as gender diversity is that I can finally talk about it, and then by talking about it, think about it more and extend it to other areas of discrimination. One day I was in an outside hospital nearby that we all know and love in the breakfast line. And I was there because everyone loves the potatoes at that breakfast. They're really good. And I was like third or fourth from the potatoes. And as I watched the server, because the potatoes would run out, and then they'd always bring usually another thing, but not always, another tray of food. As I watched, she piled the potatoes excruciatingly and slowly high onto the plate of the person across from her. I mean, she took a long time and a lot of concentration to put every last potato in this pile. And then she turned to the person next and said, "Sorry, all out."
Wow.
Wow.
The person she gave the potatoes to was white. I'm white. The person that she said sorry to was African American. And I was just astounded. I didn't see it coming. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to prevent it. I made some remark to the hungry person who didn't get potatoes that this is complete bullshit or something, that this is completely bad or something. And then I went and met with the vice president of that hospital. And I said what had happened, and since I didn't know the server's name, I'm not sure it went anywhere. I could describe her. The problem is that 15 years later, that server came to me as a patient.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And I really went through a lot of soul searching with myself and talking with my loved ones about whether to take care of that patient. Because here she was, she had hyperparathyroidism, she needed my care.
Yeah.
And she didn't know I had written her up, I had reported her to the vice president of the hospital that day for her racism. And that situation taught me a lot. What I'd like to propose is that in gender discrimination, if you can't tell, it's so pervasive in America. It's everywhere. And women and men buy into it.
Yep.
If you can't tell whether it's gender discrimination or not, transmute it into a situation of race. There are plenty of people who are still racist, but at least they recognize it. They know it's wrong. They most of the time know that it's really bad.
Right.
Okay. Even though they still do it. So it becomes more clear cut what's going on. I had a chief resident once, a wonderful surgeon, who when they were a three, a man, when he was a three at the same outside hospital, had received a consult for an infected portacath and had forgotten about it. And 2 days later, the portacath was pussed out, and I yelled at him. I reamed him a new one and said, "This is irresponsible." And he complained to another attending, a man, that I had been emasculating. And the other attending, the other attending said, "Didn't take much, did it, Sally?" Okay. And I just went on from there, because this person came from a culture where women don't yell at men. Okay. Later, when he was a chief resident, he had me sit at his table at the Harbison dinner.
Oh, wow.
Because during his career, I had been so open and fair about the racism that he must endure daily that I became a good cowboy to him.
How great is that, though, right? That you, even though at some point he must have felt very negatively towards you for, you know, in his mind, treating him that way.
Uh-huh.
But just through your own actions, right? You don't have to say anything directly to him, but through your actions of how you treat other people, how you treated him overall, you kind of changed him in a way, right? For him to
I did.
Honor
and,
you.
And he changed me. So,
yeah.
And then thank you for reminding me to say that the first real time that any Pitt trainee said, "So what's it been like being a woman in surgery?" was this winter in clinic, where a male surgeon said very pointedly and gently, "So tell me your story, what's it been like?" And I just about burst into tears. And because of the interest and the respect that sometimes we don't give to the people who came before us.
Definitely.
There have been so many strides that have been made in your time that I'm sure it's just amazing to see how we've progressed over the years. But what would you tell people who are entering the field and know that there's still a mountain to climb? What wisdom would you pass on? What advice would you give? And how can we be good advocates for each other and for the rest of our community?
So when I get to the end of the answer that is honest about your, that remind me to tell you this email story. Okay. About masks. Okay. So what I would say is that you have to lead by example. And you can't, you know, stage a rebellion and turn off your listener. You have to lead by example. And sometimes I've been too tired or demoralized to lead by good example. Sometimes I've been bruised or cranky because of all those constant insults and no one listening to those constant insults except for my poor husband, right? But what I would say is just keep doing the best you can to change the world. And you can change the world. You can do it. It's doable. Look, okay, we're doing it.
I mean, you all have done it already.
Well, a little, not all the way, though. So last month I got an email. Okay, so you know it's COVID, right? A horrible year for so many people. And these masks, the yellow masks, are the good ones. They're lightweight, they're flexible, they don't mess with your glasses, right?
I would actually like to disagree. I like the blue ones, but...
Okay, well, people who wear glasses...
Yes, I'm not a glasses wearer.
So. Like the and they're bigger, so they don't write up in your chin or your nose. So I wrote to Tammy Minear, who's the RN vice president in charge of COVID, and she's awesome. She's super capable. She's done a great job. She's responsible, reliable, and said, Tammy, can't we get these yellow masks? These blue ones are terrible. And I gave her four objective reasons why they were bad. And she appropriately said, I'm going to loop in my colleague, let's call him Steve, okay? And Steve's going to answer your question, which means, in administrative talk, that she's delegating it to someone on her team to fix it. So Steve sends me an email immediately that says, sends us both, good morning, ladies.
Oof.
Okay, now that's a little bit tone deaf, but it's not a federal crime, and it might be perfectly innocent. It's not necessarily wrong. It just perks up your ears, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, the rest of it was really bad. Yes, it makes you cringe. Because he says, Sally. He doesn't know me from Adam, and I'm 64 and a half years old, and I'm a professor of surgery. He's assumed that I'm a nurse, okay? And he says, Sally, why don't you pop down to the hospital entrance and shoot me a photo of the box of the masks you don't like?
Wow. Because, you know, I just sometimes tell people, like, just Google the person you're emailing before you email them back.
Sure, right, uh-huh. And so I replied to him, Steve, maybe you could delegate that to one of your team. Thanks, Dr. Cardi.
Good right? for you, yeah.
That kind of put-down, that's a put-down, right, is appropriate in certain circumstances, and it's something that you learn from the people around you that, you know, I am not part of his legwork or secretarial staff. So I also copied it to Tammy, and Ms. Minear sent me an immediate, oh, no, his next reply was, yes, we'll get right on the yellow masks. Thank you, Dr. Cardi. Okay, so she must have told him offline, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Right? But that's the kind of every day you call the doctor's office and say, hi, this is Dr. Cardi. Can I speak to Dr. Smith? Yes. Can you put the doctor on the line?
Oh.
That happens once a month still. Yeah. And you have to be able to roll with it. And you have to be able to say, I am the doctor. Or, yes, I'm not the nurse. I'll get you the bedpan anyway. Or whatever it is that takes care of the patient, takes care of the problem, and makes their mistake clear. When I wrote that thing for the Department of Surgery, Matt Rosengart, a department surgeon who's awesome, completely awesome, wrote back a very long, thoughtful reply that ended by saying that the founder of Taoism, he said, what is a good person but a bad person's teacher? What is a bad person but a good person's job? And that's how I feel about our time on Earth, right?
Yeah.
It's our job to be citizens and be responsible. And then when we're done, in between that, be as happy as possible.
Yep. I could not agree with that more. Leave the Earth with giving it more than you take.
That's right. That's right.
All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Follow us next for part two with Dr. Sally Cardi. This podcast was produced by Dr. Amelia Diego, Sultan Abdulhamid, Dr. Amanda Phillips, Max Glider, and me, your host, Sidra Khan, from the University of Pittsburgh Department of Surgery. The theme music was composed by Anna Elaine Lee Rosengard.